From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The fourth Democratic presidential candidate debate took place on Tuesday night in Ohio, with a slight shift in rankings among the frontrunners. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts faced the most attacks from her colleagues, a sign that she is being seen as the one to beat. Former Vice President Joe Biden's performance was lackluster, in line with his slipping poll numbers. All eyes were on Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, who had just recovered from a stent procedure following a heart attack. But Sanders dismissed concerns, saying that he felt great and focused instead on policies and the, quote, rigged economy. Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, and Beto O'Rourke maintained their moderate stances, while Kamala Harris made one splash with a remark on women's reproductive rights. Joining me to analyze the debate is Jeet Heer, National Affairs Correspondent at The Nation magazine. Welcome to the program, Jeet.
Good to be here.
So let's first talk about Warren. She is, at least in some polls, showing herself to be leading the pack of three or four front runners. I suppose it's mostly just three right now, her, Biden, and Sanders. Did you feel that the way in which her rivals went after her was an indication that she was seen as the clear front runner? Or was it just that she was being aggressive and confident?
No, I think it's clearly a sign that she's seen as the one to beat. I mean, if you remember from the earlier debates, you had that moment where Harris went after Biden, and others went after Biden as well. But I think people are kind of leaving Biden alone because even though, I mean, he's not really sunk in the polls, but he's stagnant, whereas Warren is on the rise. So she's definitely the one that was targeted. I think that's the dynamic. I think that it really broke down into teams. You really had Warren and Sanders as one kind of, progressive team, and then you had the centrist with another team. So it's interesting how it's dividing up.
And then you had the outliers like Andrew Yang and Tulsi Gabbard and Tom Steyer, who it's not quite clear where they stand. But let's talk a little bit more about Warren. In particular, one of the issues that she was challenged on was Medicare for All. She was asked how one would pay or how she plans to pay for her program. She says she is with Bernie Sanders on the Medicare for All program and the bill in particular that Sanders has introduced, but she has remained a bit vague on details. And there's a sense that she may not be as far to the left as Sanders. What do you make of her refusing to say the word taxes when asked how she would pay for it?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it is a sort of sign that either she's not fully on board or she's hoping that she can pivot more to the center once she wins the nomination. I think Bernie has what is the correct answer, which is that taxes will go up for the rich, but for the majority of people, they won't because they don't have to do premiums and co-pays. I mean, I'm up here in Canada, and while it's true that we might pay a little bit more in taxes because we don't have this sort of gargantuan healthcare bureaucracy that takes so much money, I definitely don't pay anywhere near as much as people in the United States and get universal coverage. So it's a real divide. And I think she's going to be, I think that is a her kind of Achilles heel, and there's a reason why they're going after her on that.
And healthcare is the leading issue for Americans. There's a poll just a day before the debate showing that it was the number one issue for voters. There was also a poll showing that two-thirds of Americans want a national health program backed by the government like Medicare for All, which is also quite remarkable. And actually, let's actually listen to what it was that Warren said. Here's the question followed by her answer on the issue of how to pay for Medicare for All.
You have not specified how you're going to pay for the most expensive plan, Medicare for All. Will you raise taxes?
Costs will go up for the wealthy. They will go up for big corporations and for middle-class families. They will go down. I will not sign a bill into law that does not lower costs for middle-class families.
And that is Elizabeth Warren. That was one of several times that she began her answer with, let me be clear, only to fail to actually answer the question. Now, Jeet, on the one hand, the question itself, some would argue, is a right-wing talking point. It's a red herring to say, well, how are you going to pay for this really expensive plan? Because that question doesn't take into account what we're already paying. On the other hand, it is what any Democratic nominee will face in a general election, and one needs to be prepared with a good answer, right?
That's right. Yeah, no, I think she absolutely needs a better answer than she has, and I think people are kind of right to worry about it. I mean, but it is the case that, you know, the correct answer is that actually America pays right now much more than any other comparable nation in healthcare, and even the American government pays more and gets worse results. Worse results in the number of people covered, and worse results in life expectancy and infant mortality. So, I mean, it shouldn't be too difficult to say, like, you know, the current system, as Bernie Sanders says, is terrible, and therefore there's a lot of improvements that can be made.
Now, Sanders jumped on that question as well, and he was a lot clearer in what he wanted to say, which was that there will be no copays, there'll be no deductibles, there'll be no premiums, and yes, taxes will go up, but they'll go up much more for the wealthy, and overall, they won't go up if you account for the lack of premium. So he seemed to jump on that answer and certainly win that point. And just a brief aside, in the days leading up to this debate, Sanders seems to be a little bit more in fighting spirit, although him and Elizabeth Warren sort of held their truce during this last debate. In an interview ahead of the debate, Sanders said, you know, he quoted Warren as saying that she was a capitalist to her bones, and he said, quote, I am not. Does that indicate that in future debates, as the field narrows, Sanders may start to try to distinguish himself from Warren a little bit more?
I think, I mean, he said that in response to like a kind of direct question. But if you look at what Sanders says voluntarily, he really never goes out of his way to go after Warren, and he really goes after Biden. And I think there's a very good reason for that, which is that the most likely Sanders voters are not Warren voters, they're Biden voters. That the profile of people who are sort of working class, both white working class and people of color, is more towards Biden than Warren. Warren gets the sort of college educated voters. So I think like Bernie's strategy, I think it's gonna be a long while before Bernie goes after Warren actually, because right now where he wants to get voters is where Biden is.
What do you make of Sanders' performance? He seemed like he had not had a heart attack. If one didn't know that he had had a heart attack between the last debate and this debate, he seemed himself.
Yeah, no, I thought he had a really good night. I mean, I thought he was very sharp, very aware, very forceful, and very funny. Beyond his performance, he also picked up some major endorsements. So all in all, it was a really good night. And I think, you know, he's really relaunched his campaign in a big way, which is going to continue with the rally in Queens, where Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez will be.
And in fact, that was the big news of the night as the debate was wrapping up. Both Sanders and Warren had been vying for AOC's endorsement. There were some indications that she might back Warren because she's had, you know, appearances with Warren. They've shot, you know, videos together on social media. Does AOC's endorsement, and actually the endorsement of Ilhan Omar, who was the first to endorse Bernie Sanders of this four in the squad, and Rashida Tlaib's endorsement, is that, you think, going to boost Sanders' campaign so that his somewhat sagging poll numbers might come up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually don't think his poll numbers are sagging that much. If you look at the early states, they're pretty robust. I mean, it is the case that he's sort of a little bit behind Warren and Biden, but still. But I think that it is a real boost because it really gives lie to this whole idea of the Bernie bro and who his supporters are, and really does show that it's the sort of, you know, youthful wing of the Democratic Party, which includes a lot of women and a lot of people of color, Bernie is the leader of.
And in fact, there's about an even split between men and women who support Sanders. And he actually has more people of color supporting him than whites, which is interesting. And of course, among young voters, 18 to 25, he's still far ahead of the pack. Even the New York Times, which was co-hosting the debate, grouped Sanders as one of the winners of the debate alongside Elizabeth Warren and strangely Pete Buttigieg. Let's actually now turn to Joe Biden. This is the sort of the third front runner, and the big cloud hanging over Biden was what his son Hunter Biden did under his watch when he was vice president in serving on the board of a natural gas company in the Ukraine. This is the question that Anderson Cooper asked Joe Biden, and this is how Biden answered it, or at least tried to answer it.
If it's not okay for a president's family to be involved in foreign businesses, why was it okay for your son when you were vice president? Vice President Biden?
Look, my son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. Rudy Giuliani, the president, and his thugs have already proven that they, in fact, are flat lying.
Your son, Hunter, today gave an interview, admitted that he made a mistake and showed poor judgment by serving on that board in Ukraine. Did you make a mistake by letting him? You were the point person on Ukraine at the time. If you can answer.
Look, my son's statement speaks for itself. My son made a judgment. I'm proud of the judgment he made. I'm proud of what he had to say. And let's focus on this. The fact of the matter is that this is about Trump's corruption.
And that is Joe Biden answering a question from Anderson Cooper on Tuesday night about the role that his son Hunter Biden played in serving on the board of a natural gas company named Burisma in Ukraine while Biden was vice president. What do you make of this response, Jeet? He says, my son did nothing wrong. I did nothing wrong. But that interview that Cooper was referring to, his son actually did say that he probably wouldn't have been in that position had his last name not been Biden.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very hard to put a good spin on this, except that I think, you know, Biden, put in some digs against Trump. So I think.
But both can be true at the same time, right? It can be both about Trump's corruption and about Biden's unethical behavior.
Sure. Yeah. But I mean, I think Biden is trying to rally Democrats, partisan Democrats, by bringing up Trump's name. But I mean, on the face of it, it looks very bad because of the statements Hunter Biden himself made. That he got the job because of basically nepotism and that it showed poor judgment. So for Joe Biden to suddenly say, well, I'm proud of his judgment, it makes almost no sense. And it's one of like many kind of signs that Joe Biden does not really have a coherent story or a coherent narrative. And he's not really all there.
Right. I mean, he has in a way contradicted himself because he said that if he were to be president, he wouldn't let any family members serve on boards of foreign companies, which implies that what Hunter Biden did when he was vice president might be a wrong thing to do. So Biden's frontrunner status is largely based on his, quote, electability. If Biden's inability to answer such questions is a potential liability, he may not be seen as very electable anymore, right?
Yeah, no, I think the whole electability thing is like a very shaky foundation, particularly because he's doing very poorly in the early kind of states of like Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada. And he's basically, his people have told reporters that they don't expect to win those. So if he suddenly starts to lose those early states, and you know Warren or Sanders are the ones that are winning them, that's gonna I feel like it could collapse like a house of cards. A lot of the voters who supported him because they thought he was electable will suddenly say, "Well, he's really not that electable." And this whole Ukraine business only adds to the questions because I think a lot of voters, you know, they might not like Trump and they might like Biden, but do they really want the 2020 election to be about defending Hunter Biden? Who I must say, you know, like I feel sympathy for because he's had a troubled life, but you know, he has had a lot of very dubious acts in his life.
Right. And they will come out during a general election with Trump if Biden is the nominee. Let's talk about Kamala Harris. I feel like she peaked in previous debates. This latest debate, she had one moment where during a discussion on healthcare and specifically Medicare for All, she brought in the issue of reproductive rights, a critically important issue, but that didn't quite seem to be the right place to do it. Well, let's listen to what it was that she actually said.
With all of these discussions about health care, on women's access to reproductive health care, which is under full-on attack in America today. Women are the majority of the population in this country. People need to keep their hands off of women's bodies and let women make the decisions about their own lives.
Thank you, Senator.
And let's talk about Senator. That.
That's Kamala Harris speaking on Tuesday night at the debate. And I believe it was the fourth debate, not the sixth, because some of the debates were held over two nights. I thought she made a good point there, Jeet, but it might have been, well, she made an excellent point, but it might have been the only excellent point she made during the night. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think she's right. And I think Sanders made the same point, too, when he brought up climate change. Like, why aren't we talking about that? And I think the candidates are right that the questions that they're getting from these moderators, these big media moderators, don't really reflect, you know, what Democratic Party voters want to hear or what are really the key issues of politics. So I think she was right to bring that up, and I'm glad that she tried to interject that. But yeah, I mean, and I think that will help her. But in general, I don't think it was a very strong performance, and she really continues to kind of sputter as a candidate. With her and with a lot of the other second-tier candidates, it's very hard to know why they're running and what they actually stand for. And I think that's a big problem.
Cory Booker was another one of these second tier candidates who, you know, had a few moments here and there. And he reminded us twice during the debate randomly that he was a vegan. But also he defended Biden, suggesting that Anderson Cooper's legitimate question about Hunter Biden was a Republican talking point and an attack on a statesman. What did you make of Cory Booker's performance?
Well, I think a lot of the second-tier candidates are really auditioning to be vice president. And they're like trying to show that they can be, you know, loyal party people and work within the parameters of party debates. And I think that's what, I mean, Booker on other occasions defended Warren as well. And I think his real task is to show he's a good soldier.
There's Andrew Yang, the only Asian candidate on the stage on Tuesday night, who is another one of these, you know, just kind of out of left field folks. But he, unlike candidates like Marianne Williamson, has survived and actually has been, his profile has been rising, certainly in the media. He does not have political experience. His one big issue is universal basic income. I thought he made some good points on Tuesday night. His answer on the opioid crisis was quite thoughtful. He talked about, you know, taking a non-punitive approach, a non-carceral approach to the crisis. I feel like he plays an interesting contrarian role on the debate stage that, you know, helps keep some of the other candidates on their toes. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a very good analysis. I mean, sometimes the contrarianism is on point, as you mentioned with the opioid crisis. Other times, I mean, his whole point about automation, I actually don't think automation, I think Elizabeth Warren is actually right. I mean, there's debate among economists, but I think she's closer to the truth than he is, that it's not robots that are costing the jobs so far.
And she rightly brought up unions and the importance of union power.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, my problem with Yang is I feel like his whole argument is like, well, we can't really solve these problems, so we should just like give people money, right? Like, we can't solve automation, you know, so we'll just give everybody universal basic income. Whereas I think like people really want jobs. They want to have a meaningful life. And I think that, you know, it's up to us as a society, as a democratic society, to figure out how to do that. But yeah, I mean, he does bring in like new sort of fresh, interesting ideas.
Speaking of jobs, Sanders' answer on the idea of a jobs program was, I thought, really important. He took that opportunity to bring up the Green New Deal in the absence of any discussion on climate change. This is a critical issue. This is an issue that Trump, his only claim to why he is being tolerated by his Republican allies and also by some sectors of his base is some sense that the economy is doing well for some people, and or there's, by some measures, the economy has been doing well, although even those are now failing. So the issue of the economy and economic justice is so critical. What did you make of Sanders' answer?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good, strong answer. And I think it really goes to the different vision between him and Yang, and between more broadly him and sort of Silicon Valley. Like, I think this universal basic income is very popular among Silicon Valley, but it's basically, you know, it's a kind of bread and circuses model.
Yeah.
Like, we'll give people video games and monthly income and they'll keep quiet. Whereas I think if you look at the polling, the job guarantee is much more popular. And I think for a very significant reason, which is that people feel like if they have a job, they'll have like a sort of meaningful life and also a meaningful stake in society, and that people will have to listen to them. They'll be part of unions, they'll be part of the political system. So it's a much broader vision of what it means, what work means, and rather than just like, you know, a monthly check from the government.
Tulsi Gabbard was also at the debate on Tuesday night. I'm not sure if she occupies a second or third tier of candidates, but her main sort of performance centered around the only discussion that there was on foreign policy, specifically President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops back from northern Syria. And she was fixated. I wanted to sort of count how many times she used the words regime change. She is being seen by some sectors of the left as an anti-war candidate. What did you make of her performance on Tuesday night, specifically on the issue of foreign policy?
Yeah, I mean, I find it difficult to take her that seriously as a sort of anti-imperialist or anti-war candidate, because she doesn't really extend the analysis to, you know, who's going to be harmed. And I mean, if you look at like the specific thing that's going on in Syria, I mean, what happened was that Trump gave the green light for Turkey to invade Syria. You know, this is so the United States giving its stamp of approval for one country to invade another, the way Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Or so, like, that's not an anti-war position, even though Trump tries to frame it in that way. So to suddenly bring up this issue of regime change wars in this context is to actually, you know, avoid the real anti-war a message, which is that, you know, like, what Trump has done is actually, you know, encouraged a war.
And I just did a quick search in the transcript of the debate. The term regime change was mentioned 12 times, 11 of those 12 times by Tulsi Gabbard, the 12th time by Joe Biden, who was paraphrasing her. And of course, she is seen as a deeply allied with Syrian president and dictator Bashar al-Assad and has defended him on numerous occasions. So she's certainly against the U.S. fomenting regime change against Assad. So I thought that was an interesting thing to point out for those folks who, you know, see her as an overall anti-war candidate. Well, we're nearly out of time, Ajit, but I'm wondering if you think that the complete lack of mention of climate change was just a huge failing on the part of the hosts. And that last question about Ellen DeGeneres' friendship with George W. Bush, which led to candidates scrambling and, you know, half of them fixating on John McCain, was just a huge waste of time.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, like, climate is obviously the most important issue facing, you know, not just Americans, but humanity at large. It really shows you how skewed the perspective is of networks. But it's because, these anchors, you know, Anderson Cooper and the rest, they're part of the elite. So for them, the sort of friendliness of the elite, the, you know, like, will Ellen DeGeneres have us over for dinner, is more important than the survival of the human species on a habitable planet. Which is like, which says something, I think.
Right.
About the news.
And so we'll certainly see how the next polls reflect any sort of realignment after this latest debate. And I'm not sure if you know, and I haven't really sort of seen whether there are going to be the same number of candidates or will they be winnowed down in the future. I remember there was a time when progressives were upset about too few candidates being allowed on stage because it was generally, all the Democratic candidates were generally so centrist and really right-wing, and the only ones echoing the politics of people like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the debate stage were, or that could have echoed them, would have been third-party candidates. Do you think that it's a victory that we are seeing such a large pool and somewhat ideologically diverse pool?
Yeah, no, I think that, I mean, it makes it harder to really sort out the messages, but it is good that there's a vigorous debate, and I think the DNC has learned its lesson. I think in 2016 they overmanaged and they winnowed too quickly, and that was a problem. And so now they might have gone the opposite direction, but it's still an improvement. And actually, I mean, right now I believe they've had 6 or 7 people have met the threshold for the next debate. So I fully expect we might get up to like 10. Right. You know, 12.
And it's telling that 2 out of the top 3 candidates are the strongest progressives on that stage, which really shows that when those ideas are expressed on a national stage, they gain traction. We didn't get to some of the other candidates. I thought Beto O'Rourke, his one issue of gun control was the strongest one. He hit the hardest on it, and he seemed to be the most, going the furthest on the issue of gun control. Pete Buttigieg, we also didn't quite get to, but he seemed to sort of dig his heels on a moderate position and be sort of taking on Amy Klobuchar for who would be the most palatable moderate on the stage. Any last thoughts, Jeet, on issues that we didn't get to?
No, I think that's basically right. I mean, I think with Buttigieg and Klobuchar as well, one way to think about it is they might be auditioning for vice president Biden gets the nomination. So, I know it's an interesting kind of a mix of people. But no, it's absolutely the case that Sanders and Warren are the ones that are setting the terms of the debate, and they're the center of gravity, and everything revolves around them.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jeet, for joining us today. I really appreciate it. We'll post a link to your Nation magazine page so people can read your writings.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Jeet here is the national affairs correspondent at The Nation magazine. We've been discussing Tuesday night's Democratic candidate debate. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our video channel on Vimeo, and find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.